He was subsequently found to be an habitual criminal because of those felonies, and he was sentenced to a term of 10 to 15 years with the Department of Corrections that run concurrently because of those convictions, that felony convictions. He was convicted under a statute for non-support that has two prongs. There's, I suppose, normal non-support, which would be a misdemeanor, a Class 2 misdemeanor. And then he was convicted of felony non-support, which is a Class 4 felony. And what makes it a felony is the fact that it's pursuant to any order of any court. It's my position today, there's two main points, is that that has to be a valid order, and that's an essential element of the offense of felony non-support, and has to be found by a jury, not by a judge. That issue was never even raised to the jury during the trial. So the temporary order, which is Exhibit 13 in this matter, was a temporary child support order that was issued between the months of August and November.
So is the child support order still intact? Is there still an order?
As far as I know, Your Honor, there's an ongoing order. The child is 7 years old at this point, so it would be an ongoing order for him. I assume there would be some kind of modification to minimal support, I would hope. Otherwise, there will be a huge debt at the end of this child's minority when he's released if this court doesn't act.
Counsel, there was no doubt that the court that issued the child support order had subject matter jurisdiction to issue the order, correct?
Yes, there was subject matter jurisdiction.
And it's also, there's no doubt that that court had obtained personal jurisdiction over your client.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you're really attempting to go beyond a void order to a valid order, in other words, to challenge not whether it was void for lack of jurisdiction, but whether the original court, the district court that entered that child support order, should have made the order that it did.
I think the due process issue that I'm raising is that during the temporary order, he had no ability to appeal that. And he had no ability, and even if he were to appeal that, there was no child support calculation attached to Exhibit 13. So this court or the Court of Appeals would have automatically remanded that summarily and said attach a child support calculation. There's issues with the temporary order even beyond that, in that there was a lack of evidence, and the district court acknowledged that in its order. It said it plucked a number out of the air and issued a temporary order.
But none of those arguments go to voidness of the temporary order.
I don't believe I can void that order at this stage, and I would have to be within that case and appeal that case and that final judgment.
A void order can be challenged in any proceeding.
I understand, but it's not void. My issue here is validity for a criminal prosecution that ultimately leads to a felony conviction.
So you would suggest that a jury is entitled to, in a felony prosecution for non-support, is entitled to second guess the validity of an order of the district court?
Your Honor, I wouldn't say second guess. I would say that issue should be raised and that fact must be found by the jury. That's the way I would frame that.
What is the jury to find? What would you suggest the jury has to find there?
The jury has to find that it's a valid order from any order of any court. And I think that's an issue that could be raised to the jury. I think it's an essential element of the offense of felony non-support, which the legislature made it so we could look at a Class 2 misdemeanor or a Class 4 felony. And I can't tell a distinction between a legal obligation for support of the child and then pursuant to an order. The prosecution here used an order to do that in this case, and I think the jury has to find that fact, that it was an order.
The legislature in the criminal non-support statute didn't use the word valid. They just said an order of any court.
That's correct, Your Honor, and it also said that it was any legal obligation, and that would be a Class 2 misdemeanor, and that's in the first section of that statute. And so the second following that makes it a felony would be the any order of any court.
Well, I think there is no doubt, is there, that there was a legal obligation. I mean, it was his child, wasn't it?
That was, attorney was established, it would be his child, it would be a legal obligation pursuant to an order is the issue, and I think implicit in that, and that's, you're absolutely correct, Your Honor, I have to view implicit in the legislative language, is that it's a valid order. Because the issue that, at least I find in this, is that you run into some kind of hypothetical where there's a temporary order that is ordered, but invalid. There's nothing a defendant can do about it, or father or mother can do about that order, because it's temporary. And then during that time, if they're unable to pay it, they could be criminally prosecuted as felons because of that temporary order. On the will of a prosecutor, that's an issue that I see.
You see, you believe there's no remedy?
I believe there's, under the circumstance that I just described, I think there would be a difficult remedy, and one of those remedies is what Mr. Erpelding is before you today on, which is a reversal of the...
You see no other form of action?
Well, at the final, some kind of final determination, he would have an ability to appeal the child support order once it's a final appealable order.
But are we going to say that all temporary orders in all these divorce cases throughout the state are now appealable?
I'm not asking the court to do that. Excuse me?
Is that what you're asking us to say?
No, Your Honor. I'm not saying that it's appealable. I'm saying that in order to convict someone of felony non-support, there has to be an opportunity to have some due process regarding that order that you're using to convict this person.
If the prior order were examined, what do you think would have been wrong with it?
At least two...
This individual is not the person named in that prior order?
No.
Like a quorum nobis, you got the wrong guy, I'm not really dad, and stuff like that?
No, I don't believe that is what he would appeal it on. I think it would be an evidentiary kind of issue regarding that appeal, if the court hypothetically were to take that onto appeal. Plus, there's the child support calculation not being attached, because the court didn't find sufficient evidence, I suppose, and it said it plucked it out of the air, to issue a direct child support examination.
Even if we were to go down that path, wouldn't we ultimately end up that the evidence would have been, there would at least have been an order for minimal support under the guidelines? So you still would have an order at the end of the day, wouldn't you?
You would have a temporary order that would become a final order. I think the rule that I'm asking this court to establish would be that in order to convict on a criminal non-support and have that be an order, there has to be some due process in looking over that order. There has to be a final appealable order.
It has to become final so you can have appellate review.
Yes, Your Honor. That's all I'm asking. I think that's the rule that could be established here, and Mr. Erpelding would benefit from that. The
Is the habitual criminal enhancement in this case carry a mandatory minimum?
10 years minimum, I think, would be mandatory.
So he has to serve 10 years?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. In this case, he's serving 10 years mandatory minimum, and his 30 days of good time doesn't kick in until that 10 years is done.
Were there any contempt proceedings filed before the criminal action was filed?
Not that I'm aware of, Your Honor. I don't believe so. I think the prosecutor went straight for the criminal non-support in this matter. The Apprendi is an issue that I raised, and Your Honor mentioned that in a different way. I believe under Apprendi, the jury has to find that fact about the order. I think it's an element of the offense that enhances the offense and makes it go from a Class 2 misdemeanor to a felony, and I think we have to have a jury find that. There was no jury instructions on that. The jury didn't make that.
Didn't element 2 of the jury instruction on elements say that the defendant knew he was legally obliged to provide support to that child by an order of the district court, Buffalo County, entered on August 20, 2012, in case number so on? And doesn't that put it squarely before the jury?
Not in my perspective, Your Honor. I don't believe that it was just copying the language out of the information and placed before the jury. The validity of the order was never questioned.
Well, there we go back. I mean, the jury was asked to find the existence of an order, but they weren't asked to find the existence of a valid order.
It wasn't ever from my reading of the instructions, it wasn't ever captured as a element of the offense. It was just a given. That is, I see that I'm out of time. Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Klein, good morning.
May it please the Court, Mr. Chief Justice, I'm Kimberly Klein, Assistant Attorney General representing the state in this matter. Your Honor, with respect to the validity of the prior order, first of all, that's a legal question, one which a jury would never be asked to determine. That's not what a jury does. It's not what a jury ever does. Secondly, what he really wants is to mount a collateral attack, which this Court has long defined as an attack in a way other than by proceeding in the original action to have that order vacated, modified, or reversed. That's exactly what he wants to have done in this case, and a collateral attack on that order is simply not appropriate under these circumstances or in this particular case.
Counsel, you may be right, but doesn't this case strike you as having a really difficult result for failure to pay child support, that he's now in penitentiary for 10 years at a cost of $30,000 a year for failure to pay $225 a month?
Well, the problem
I mean, isn't that an unusual outcome that he's now an habitual criminal and confined now for 10 years? How's he ever going to pay any support?
If he's working in the penitentiary, they can attach those wages.
Yeah,
he wasn't paying to start with, so I'm not sure that we're really out anything.
But it seems to me this is a very harsh result for...
It is a harsh result, but the fact of the matter remains that this was charged and proved to be an intentional violation, a willful refusal to pay. He had the capacity... Ironically, started this whole proceeding by filing a petition to establish paternity and child support, I would note, and alleged in that petition that he was basically ready, willing, and able to support the child, and then immediately failed to do so.
Refresh my memory, what was the evidence of ability to pay? Wasn't he in construction business and
had
problems paying his debts? And was there evidence that what he grossed really wasn't net because he had to pay a crew?
Well, I
know that goes beyond the jury just decided that, but boy, like Judge Wright says, this just...
Well, really, at the hearing on the setting the support, neither party presented really any evidence. The court said, I've got to pluck a number out of the air, right?
Yes, and the reason the district court was obliged to make that decision is that the defendant simply refused to provide any information. What the court had before it was information that the defendant had.
Well, he didn't pay income taxes. He didn't have any records. It wasn't fair to refuse. He didn't have any.
Well, he did have income, and there was proof to that effect. I mean, he's got... The evidence at the trial showed that he's got two pickup trucks, a Harley motorcycle, a Bobcat that he used in his construction business. There was also testimony that in May, I believe it was, of 2012, he was paid.
Attach those pieces of property and sell them and pay off the child support as a lien instead of costing the state $300,000 to incarcerate somebody for failure to pay support?
This case was pushed by the DHHS, who was making payments to her. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct.
This DHHS tried to get their money back.
Right. There was almost immediately the defendant started failing to pay, and the state started paying ADC for the child. And after repeated refusals to pay, they started... HHS started taking action to try and essentially coerce him into paying, and that I think they managed to wring one payment out of him, but that was only after he decided he wanted his driver's license back and found the money to pay for that, and then once he got that back, the money dried up again. He's got money to pay for what he wants to pay for and doesn't have it for when he doesn't want to pay it. I think that fact was driven home pretty forcefully by the testimony from the banker who essentially refinanced a number of loans, took an interest in some collateral of his, and then when he again failed to pay on that loan, they tried to go collect the collateral, and he wouldn't tell them where it was, or he had basically hidden it from them. So he's got ability to pay. I think the jury was very clear and correct in finding that. It's just he doesn't want to.
Well, getting back to, I know the barn door has been closed, but wouldn't a contempt proceeding given him the keys to the jail, wouldn't that have worked?
Probably not. I think because it's a willful failure, and I can probably pretty much guarantee you what he would have done is come up with the money to satisfy the contempt, promptly stopped paying again, and we'd just run through this cycle over and over and over and over again.
But there's no economic reality to this case. The state now incurs $300,000 of costs in incarcerating this person, and DHHS has to continue to pay ADC because he's not available to make any payments. I know it's done and over, but I just don't
well,
see
I think the
reality.
I think the point of
this
is to make a point to other people who are refusing to pay when they can and should be. This guy's got ability to pay, at least pay something. Even the temporary payments were incredibly low, like $225, I think, a month. I think they got one payment out of him in October, and that was literally the month after they filed the charges on him.
But he was giving her some cash.
That's the allegation, I think.
Well, she agreed to it, that she was getting cash from him.
Yeah, she also agreed that she had lied under oath in a prior proceeding saying she wasn't, so I think the jury found her testimony to be iffy at best.
Isn't the issue about whether or not criminal charges should have been brought a matter of prosecutorial discretion that belongs to the executive branch?
Exactly. And
so it's your discretion to have brought or not brought this case, right?
It was the prosecutor's discretion to bring or not bring, absolutely.
How about whether or not to enhance? Is there discretion? The habitual aspect, is that discretionary?
Well, it's not discretionary if the state has charged him as an habitual, which they did. I guess,
let me back up. Is charging as habitual discretionary?
Oh, sure. Sure, any charges. It's within the discretion of the prosecutor. And I'll admit that this one does have the appearance of being heavy-handed, but then again, I think you have to look at this particular defendant. He's got a criminal history that you could paper your walls with. He also, at the time of his sentencing in this thing, had pending sentencing on felon in possession of a firearm, dealing methamphetamine, driving on a suspended license, and one or two other things. It's not just that he is willfully refusing to pay. It's that he is, in fact, an habitual criminal.
Was the habitual charge properly noticed in accordance with 212?
Yeah. Yeah, I think it was, Your Honor. There is not, and I have never seen a separate notice of habitual criminal. Typically, and I don't know if I've ever seen it done any other way, when they go to sentencing, the first thing that happens is they have the enhancement hearing. The statute also requires that the allegation of being an habitual criminal be filed with the information, which it was in this particular case. So I think the statute essentially requires your notice right up front with the charging, and because the statute also requires that prior to sentencing you engage in the enhancement proceedings.
Pardon me, how about the three-day notice aspect? Was that complied with?
I think it was. There have been a couple cases from this, a Cole, a 1974 case, that says essentially really what the three-day notice is going after is giving the defendant notice and an opportunity to defend against the charges. That being the case, you get that notice when the information is filed, but certainly when you are given a sentencing date. Because prior to that sentence being imposed, which is on a fixed date by the court order, there will be an enhancement hearing. Whether it's 10 seconds before the sentence is imposed or a week before the sentence is imposed, it will be before the sentence is imposed.
What are the facts here, if you recall, in terms of the three-day notice,
the
statutory provision?
After he was convicted, the district court set a sentencing order, and there was some discussion about it, because there was apparently a change in judges between the trial and the sentencing court, and there was some discussion about this, and it was explained to the judge who ultimately did the sentencing that it was basically the habit and the custom of the judge who set the sentencing date to go through and immediately prior to sentencing have the enhancement hearing. And frankly, that's the way I've seen it done, I think, in every case I've seen habitual done. But I think the district court
said... But, I mean, there's a range of customs, evidently. I mean, I think in Douglas County, they make it a count. Habitual as a count, which I'm not sure if it's quite right, but evidently, where are we, in Buffalo County?
Yes,
it's like day of or something. I don't know the custom there. But
well,
I guess my point being, does the defendant have adequate notice
I think
the risks are of this prosecution?
Yeah, I think, he's got notice, at least, that he's going to at some point have to defend against this by virtue of the information that's filed. And once the court fixes a date for sentencing, he knows that at some point, either on that date or prior to it, that he will have to be defending against the habitual criminal charges because the statute requires that the enhancement hearing occur prior to the imposition of sentence.
If we say the three-day notice is bad in this case, when what happens?
Vacate the sentence and remand for a...
Resentencing.
Resentencing and notice of an enhancement hearing?
I suppose that's the worst that would happen. I don't know. I don't think there was any prejudice. I mean, he didn't really... His only complaint about one of the prior convictions from Arizona was that he alleged he wasn't represented by counsel. The record refuted that. I don't know. I guess it would be... My point is it would be kind of an exercise in futility to do that because I'm not sure that there's anything to be gained by it, but it's... If you find that three... I don't think the statute really requires that there be a separate notice of an habitual hearing to be held. I think the cases prior to this have construed that notice to just be essentially... The purpose of that is to give him notice that he is going to have to defend against it. I think every time, because the way the statute is worded, it's almost a superfluous requirement, really, because you have to be given notice in the information. And secondly, the statute also requires that it be done prior to the actual sentencing proceedings. So I think you've basically been given twice notice under the statute. And the three-day thing is, I don't really truly understand the whole point of that.
How does a defense lawyer effectively prepare for a sentencing hearing when he or she doesn't know whether his or her client is convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor? They don't know prior to sentencing whether it's enhanced or not. How do they make a judgment about how they should approach the sentencing issue?
Doesn't the
putting off the decision about enhancement until immediately before sentencing put a defense lawyer in a very difficult situation about what you do at sentencing?
I don't think so, because the habitual determination is made on what's on your prior convictions, and he is probably equally as well able to find out what his client's prior convictions are as anyone.
But if it's not in the information here, is that correct?
No, it was charged.
I beg your pardon.
Yeah, he was charged from the outset in the information. The fourth count was that he's an habitual criminal. So that's required by statute, and that was complied with. So
I beg your pardon.
I see I am over my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? We will go on then to the next case of the day, which is In Re Interest of NCJ. Is it Mr. Campagna?
Mr. Worth.
Mr. Worth. I'm sorry, yes, Mr. Worth. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, I am Mr. Wirt, the attorney for the appellate.